Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. Hello, everybody. It's Jeremy Faust, and this is the October 2020 issue of ASAP Now. And we've got a lot of political stuff in this issue. We've got updates on ABEM recertification, and we had some information about safe elections in the time of a pandemic, including a front page story. There was a collaboration between ID physicians and emergency physicians. But I think that for the podcast format, we're going to focus in on the clinical aspects that we covered. Really some great stuff in this month's issue, in print and online, as always. Let's start with an article called Under Pressure, Abdominal Compartment Syndrome in the Emergency Department by Michael Gottlieb and Britt Long. And this is part of our low prevalence, high risk series, because these are things that we have to think about. And we also want to be able to intervene when it matters. So this issue, we have abdominal compartment syndrome. And let's just start with the grading systems. We all know that essentially abdominal compartment syndrome is when, well, it's pretty obvious, when there's too much pressure up in there. And I think we all know this is going to be, for us, a clinical diagnosis, but it does make some sense to just talk through really the kind of etiologies of these to think about. Because if you know the four major sources of this condition, it's easier to think about it and look out for it when it might crop up. So the first of the four categories is anything that causes reduced abdominal wall compliance. So that could be things like obesity or having surgery, so there's scarring. Then the next thing could be increased abdominal contents, so things that can do that. I think the most common thing we're going to see would be large volume ascites. I think that is certainly a place where we think about it. Someone who needs a large volume paracentesis, well, at some point, it can cause that increase in abdominal pressure, and we have the diagnosis. Hemoperitoneum, also another one, similar. And the next category would be things that increase the pressure because of increased intraluminal contents. So that would be things like ileus, gastroparesis. And finally, the last major cause to think about conceptually would be capillary leak. Things like sepsis, pancreatitis, these are things that are going to cause fluid to be moving out and around and eventually not being cleared. So you've got an increased pressure there. And what I think is really impressive here in the magazine is measuring intra-abdominal pressure, intra-abdominal hypertension or intra-abdominal pressure in the suspected abdominal compartment syndrome. We can do this. We can actually do this in the ED. And basically we've got a 14-step diagram here. But what I'll tell you is, I'm not going to go through it step by step here because that would be pointless. But refer to it. It's on page 10 of the magazine. And what I love about this is essentially it's a combination of a few things that we know how to do. So I know it sounds crazy, but actually it's not, because all your nurses know how to place a Foley catheter. You can do that. And you also know how to prime an arterial line, or if you don't, someone in your department does. And if you have those abilities, then actually you can do this, because ultimately what we're doing with measuring intra-abdominal pressure in the emergency department is to place a Foley catheter in a bladder, to introduce some fluid, and to wait a little while, and to use A-line setup to measure the pressure. And eventually, after a few minutes of doing this, you put some fluid into the bladder, and then you let it equilibrate, and you let the transducer do its thing, it picks up the pressure. And so you can actually demonstrate to a surgeon, for example, that you have actually detected an increase in intra-abdominal pressure that is consistent with compartment syndrome. And I would say if I do this once in my career, hey, maybe twice, maybe 10 times, who knows? But if I do it once, I will be very happy with myself. And I think that it's totally doable based on this article. So I want you to consider that and add it to your list of things that you feel like you can do. And we've got the nice diagrams and show you how to do it right there in the magazine. All right, let's move on to our next clinical topic. By the way, speaking of clinical topics, we're not going to go through all of this right here, but ASAP actually has a ton of apps that you can download and put on your smartphone that have quite a number of really useful features. So we all know the basics, right? I think anyone listening to this podcast knows the basics, but things like buprenorphine use in the emergency department and managing acute pain, getting a little bit more creative than the usual, and suicide assessment, these are things we can do decently, but there are actually apps for all those things. And there's also an app for sepsis management. There's apps for AFib and flutter. Again, all the basics I'm sure you all know if you're listening to my voice right now. But the peripheral brain, as we call it, the iPhone or the Android, these apps really take it to the next step and I think are really useful. So we actually had a little bit of a feature on that in the magazine. The next thing we're going to cover in the magazine, October, is some really great updates on managing pneumothorax. And this comes from our good friend and our columnist, Dr. Ryan Radecki, and his column, EM Literature of Note, Pearls from the Medical Literature. And this month, his article is about the condition that I kind of love to treat, the primary spontaneous pneumothorax. And the question is, should we actually do much about that? Should we put the chest tubes in? Should we intervene? I was hoping he'd say yes, because I like my job as an ER doc. It's fun to stick a chest tube or a pigtail on these suckers and watch them get better. Of course, it's not about me. It's about the patient. So Ryan took us through some literature on this, and the most interesting sort of recent data was a trial that looked at 552 patients. Granted, not a lot of evidence on all of this, but this is a bigger one for this particular condition. And this trial basically said, can you do nothing? Can you really just do nothing? And patients were eligible for the trial if they had moderate or large pneumothorax. And that was defined as 32% collapse as per the chest radiograph. And the intervention group, the group of people who would get a tube from somebody like me, who's all excited to get in there and get a tube into the pneumothorax and make it better. The intervention group patients underwent placement of a French Seldinger style chest tube of 12 or smaller, and they were rechecked 4 hours later. And they could actually have that chest tube removed and be discharged if things were going okay and there was radiographic improvement. On the other hand, you had your comparison group who were just observed. They did nothing. Even with a 32% or a larger pneumothorax, they just, as we say, sat there and did nothing and basically were watched for any signs of clinical or radiographic deterioration. And if nothing happened, they got to go home. And in this particular trial, the researchers were looking for an endpoint of the resolution of the pneumothorax by 8 weeks. Keep that in mind. So this is not really about necessarily the acute outcome, although I think obviously the patients who have any sort of genuine tension physiology are not in this trial. So the patients who obviously aren't in tension pneumothorax, do these patients do okay at 8 weeks? And they had in-person assessments frequently in this study, which is the nice thing about studies is the authors and investigators have the opportunity to follow up patients, always good. And it turns out that doing nothing was almost as good. I'm not going to sit here and say that doing nothing was as good or better, but it was pretty close. Let's talk about it. At the 8 week follow-up, 94.4% of the primary spontaneous pneumothorax that had conservative management, i.e. nothing, they had full lung re-expansion, 94.4%. But those who actually had the chest tube or pigtail or some kind of small device put in, 98.8% of those actually had the full re-expansion. So there is that 4.4% difference in outcomes by placing a small chest tube-like device. But you have to take this into consideration when you're thinking about this. Think about what it means to have a device placed. That means they're going to have more chest x-rays. They're going to obviously be in the hospital longer. You might miss work. And I found this surprising, that in the folks who had the intervention, there's actually a higher rate, twice the rate, of pneumothorax recurrence within a year, 12 months, 16.8% versus 8.8%. So as Ryan points out, these are longer term secondary outcomes, but there are things to consider, that even if you get that 4.4% advantage in full lung re-expansion by 8 weeks by having that placement of a smaller chest tube than doing nothing, that it comes with some costs, and that cost can mean things like being in the hospital and having to miss work, and even, as we just mentioned, a higher rate of recurrence, which is interesting, I think. And I wonder if this is because the chest tube is artificially expanding things, whereas doing nothing, the body is doing its own work, and whatever remodeling has to be done in the short and medium term is done by our bodies. Like, our bodies are amazing. They heal themselves when we aren't at death's doorstep. So obviously, again, the tension pneumothorax is not included in this study, but really interesting that, unfortunately, one of my favorite procedures, which is to place a pigtail for a chest tube or even a large bore chest tube in the right situation, now I'm being told that maybe a lot of the time it's not that necessary. And of course, to reiterate, we are not talking about patients who have any hemodynamic compromise. This is not the tension pneumothorax, and these are not the traumatic pneumothoraces. These are the primary spontaneous pneumothoraces that come into the hospital and who surprise us sometimes, I think. So, really interesting, I thought. And there's actually another couple of studies that Ryan covers about some portable devices and some other literature, as usual. So, as is so often the case, we are just scraping the surface here of what's in the magazine for October. Now, I know I mentioned that we were going to spend most of our time on this episode really doing clinical stuff, not doing any political stuff, even though we covered elections and ER docs who ran for Congress, and we had some stuff on buprenorphine, lots of good stuff. And I also wanted to stop before we did another clinical topic just to pause and mention a column that we don't always cover here in the podcast, because it's called Images in EM. And it's not the podcast milieu is just not the exact right way to cover that particular column, but it's a great column we've had for a while, and it's done by Dr. Benjamin Thomas, who is a photographer and really a wonderful writer as well. And Dr. Thomas has an entry on page 23 of the October magazine that I would really recommend you all take a look at. It's about learning from our mistakes as physicians and the fact that we're human, and he starts with a quote: the hardest thing about being a doctor is that you learn best from your mistakes, and mistakes are made on living people. So he's got just an incredibly vibrant photograph that we produce in the magazine, and then he talks us through a case that stuck with him. And for all the articles that we read and cover that make us better clinical physicians, this is one of those articles that'll make you a better clinical physician, because it'll make you stop and think about what it is we do and how we do it. So I recommend you check that out, and thank Dr. Thomas for doing that for us. It's such a beautiful addition to have his photography and his writing in the magazine. And now, without further ado, let's get back to some clinical stuff. And we had a really interesting article a while back about ovarian torsion and some myths about ovarian torsion. And that article really had some great dispelling of myths, including the fact that that very scary disease can show up in ways other than the classic way. So you don't necessarily need to have the female reproductive age showing up with the on-off classic sort of paroxysmal pain. And another one that I just want to throw in here, I just can't resist, but the CAT scan really does have a role. Yes, we get the Doppler. Yes, we get the ultrasound. We get the specialist involved early. It's a clinical diagnosis. But the CT scan does have so many excellent secondary signs, so that if you're not sure, it's a good adjunct. But let's talk about what we got in the October, which is EM cases. And this is from Anton Hellman. And Dr. Hellman writes for us on lots of clinical topics from time to time when he joins us for his column. And this is five tips on testicular torsion. Just want to walk you through them. We have a really fantastic ultrasound of that process with the Doppler on. And I'll tell you from personal experience, this is not hard to do, to take your point of care ultrasound with a linear probe and do the exam at the bedside and look for flow. If you do not see red and blue when you're doing the ultrasound on the testicle you're worried about, and you can find it on the contralateral side, then you have your diagnosis almost made. So my personal tip here is just to make sure you always, if you're worried, it takes so little time just to do a point of care ultrasound, and don't let it talk you out of it. Get that official study, and it's a time-dependent diagnosis, but I will tell you, you're not going to lose much time by doing that, and in fact, you might hasten your phone call to the specialist. Now let's get to these five tips from Anton Hellman. Number one, time counts, but salvageability is possible more than 48 hours after symptom onset. And I think this is important because so often we're taught, of course, time is testicle or time is really important. And we have this sort of fatalistic thing that if we miss the diagnosis, that we are just not going to help the patient in time. And I think it's fantastic that we have to remember that there's twisting and there's untwisting, there's torsing and untorsing. And so, in fact, there are success rates that go beyond the 48-hour mark. Now, the degree of twisting and duration of symptoms are prognostic factors, with 96% success rates when perfusion is restored within 4 hours. But salvage is less than 10% if the interventions are delayed for more than 24 hours. But still, salvageability has been shown beyond 48 hours after symptom onset. And I think that's important because you never want to rule it out just by timing. Just go ahead and do the study. It's really not bad to be wrong in that direction. But it would be terrible to be wrong if on the 49th hour or 40th hour, there was something to be salvaged and you didn't get there. Tip number two, that torsion can occur at any age. The truth is it can occur at any age. And I will tell you, I've had arguments with my urology friends at my training institution. I haven't had this happen where I'm at now, but where it was like, oh, this guy's too old to have it. And I was like, he doesn't know that because he's got it. So watch out, because we can have this disease occur in people who are over the age of 40, even though the mean age is certainly in the 20s. Number three, torsion can present with minimal intermittent or no scrotal pain. And this is, of course, what we all don't want to hear, which is, again, that the classic teaching, the board teaching, the way you'll teach your residents, yeah, that's all true, but don't diagnostically close if something isn't adding up, because sometimes there are patients who have constant pain. They are those who have these pain honeymoons that can last a long time, of course, which is the torsion story that we were taught about. But don't be distracted or confused if it's not classic. The next thing is to remember, number four, there's no single symptom or sign or combination of clinical features with adequate predictive value in ruling out torsion. Again, this is why we all became physicians, because, yeah, there are signs, there are things like the presence of an elevated testicle. That odds ratio is 58.8. All right, that's ridiculously substantial, okay? I'm not going to lie. And also the horizontal testicular lie is noted to be increased, that has an increased likelihood. But the thing is, none of those things, if present or absent, really can end the investigation if you're worried. So it's just really interesting to point out that, yes, the things we were taught about were pretty important, but they're not the end all and be all. And I also like that the classic, the presence of a cremasteric reflex does not rule out the diagnosis of testicular torsion. And the studies report varying sensitivities as low as 60%. And I'll tell you, 60% sensitivity is no good for a condition like testicular torsion. We all know that. So yeah, you can check for it, but it's not something that I rely on for that reason. And then lastly, bringing it full circle, Doppler ultrasound does have limitations in the diagnosis of testicular torsion. And yes, there are lots of things that will tell us that it should be considered highly ruled in. And certainly we talked about this in the beginning of this section of the podcast, where I mentioned that I myself like to do a point of care using the linear transducer with Doppler to look, to decide whether or not I need to really expedite things. Obviously, in any case, this is a diagnosis that you don't hem and haw about. If you think about it, you got to push them over to the ultrasound suite and you got to call the consultant. But again, I don't think it takes much. 2 minutes of your time can actually save you time down the road if you actually fail to see flow, because that'll be really impressive. But just again, like all these things, it's not perfect. So we do have to keep in mind that partially torsed testicles, for example, could have arterial flow, but they wouldn't have venous flow. And so the sensitivity of Doppler ultrasound for this is going to be somewhere between 80 and 100% would be great. Fine. But we all know that 88% is not great for this condition. So that is your five tips on managing testicular torsion. And that actually does bring us to the end of this episode of ASAP Nowcast. Again, check us out online at ASAP Now on the web and, of course, at home in your inbox. And please reach out to me with any questions or ideas for the show and for the magazine. We always want to reflect the work and ideas that you bring to the table and to your communities every single day. So thanks so much, and we'll see you next time. ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.